Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Say what you will about those surging profits at banks that were begging with hat in hand not so long ago. Those hoards of cash will almost certainly reignite the debate over big bonuses it seems sure to follow. But you didn't hear a lot of Wall Street investors complaining today as the Dow Industrials managed to climb back above the 10,000 mark. Hallelujah! For the first time in a year. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. 7 million K-12 students are enrolled in school districts that use software from SunGard Public Sector. More information at SunGard.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you here on this Wednesday, the 14th of October. So after months of hopeful anticipation, or maybe high anxiety, the Dow has crossed back into the magic five-digit range. It was nudged over that psychological hurdle today in large part by J.P. Morgan Chase. The bank posted its biggest profits in more than a year, $3.6 billion for the third quarter. Impressive, to be sure. But take a closer look and you'll see the stellar figures aren't across the board. As Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports, that's what we're seeing in the rest of the economy, too.
More than half of J.P. Morgan's total profits for the quarter come from one division, investment banking. The division brought in $1.92 billion. That's 85% more than last year. Stuart Plesser follows the banking industry for Standard & Poor's.
It was a combination of strong investment banking fees and also trading revenue, combined with their ability to mark up some of the securities that were previously marked down.
Plesser says there's been plenty of activity on Wall Street, and investment banks should be able to keep making money.
As long as interest rates are very low, as they are now, the cost of capital is very low. There's a lot of ways for them to make money off that low cost of capital.
So much for Wall Street. But the parts of the bank that do business with the rest of America look very different. The mortgage and consumer banking division made a measly $7 million this quarter, and its credit cards lost $700 million. Joel Naroff is an economist. He says the numbers reflect what's happening in the real world. People are still losing jobs. They're having trouble paying their mortgages, and they're nervous.
The consumer is just starting the process of spending again, but they're not out there shopping till they're dropped. And I think any company that's associated with consumer spending is going to see that in their numbers.
That's okay with J.P. Morgan's CEO Jamie Dimon. He says the consumer side of things is stabilizing, though he's not ready to call it a trend yet. And those record profits on the Wall Street side? He says shareholders shouldn't expect them every quarter as more banks get back into the game. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
For all the celebrating on Wall Street today, it's all tempered by the suffering of millions of Americans still struggling to get by. The White House is looking for ways to spread the wealth. Today, President Obama urged Congress to approve additional economic recovery payments of $250 next year for senior citizens, military veterans, and the disabled. He says that relief will spread throughout the economy. Those payments would be especially welcomed by Social Security recipients who won't be seeing cost of living increases this year. Mary Liz Burns speaks for the AARP.
$250 may not provide enough relief for every single American, but the key is this is the right recognition at the right time for these folks who are struggling to make ends meet.
The White House says it's committed to ensuring the $13 billion cost doesn't hurt the coffers of Social Security or other social assistance programs. It can take years of marketing and millions of dollars to build a prestigious brand, but sometimes it's just easier and cheaper to buy some cachet. That seems to be what Bloomberg has in mind with its decision to buy Business Week magazine. The price tag, an estimated and paltry $5 million. Bloomberg is famous in the world of hardcore financial news and data, but it's not so well known outside that world. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Bloomberg earns most of its money from leasing computer terminals. They provide financial data and news to traders and bankers. But with so many layoffs on Wall Street, Bloomberg has lost thousands of subscribers. Porter Bibb runs Media Tech Capital Partners. He says with Business Week, Bloomberg will be able to reach a whole new audience in the executive suite.
To see if they can broaden the terminal offering, which is still going to be the core of their business and the main profit spinner, beyond hardcore, sophisticated financial executives and get out into the corporate world.
Bloomberg also wants to expand its business beyond terminals. Lucia Moses is with MediaWeek. She says Bloomberg has more than 2,000 journalists, but until now they've had a specialized audience of market watchers.
And they feel like in order to get their name out there with major business leaders, you know, they need a big, well-known, iconic consumer brand like Businessweek behind them.
And they intend to make a profit. Robert Boynton teaches journalism at New York University.
The thing that people can't quite get their head around is they want to do something so incredibly unfashionable, such as invest in content and distribution and reporting and maybe create a magazine that people will not only want to read but might want to pay for.
He says Bloomberg can afford to invest in the magazine. The company has no debt and one billionaire owner, the mayor of New York. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Vladimir Putin's wrapping up a trip to China today, talking energy. The Russian prime minister met with Chinese President Hu Jintao as both sides try to make a deal for Russia to sell natural gas to China. Remember when Red Russia and Red China were Cold War rivals? These days, it's all about economic collaboration. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from Shanghai.
When Putin pops over to China these days, it's a business trip, and politics takes a back seat. The two countries signed $3.5 billion in trade and investment deals. One has Russia doubling its oil sales to China to 600,000 barrels a day. That makes Moscow a key supplier and helps it diversify its customer base beyond Europe. Economist Kang Wu is with the East-West Center in Honolulu.
For the national interest of Russia, they certainly want to open up the Far East. For many years, if not decades, Asia-Pacific region is where the growth is.
China, the importer, wants to get more diverse, too. It's taking affirmative steps away from depending on the Middle East and Africa. Oil from those parts comes on tankers that navigate dicey waters known as the Straits of Malacca. There are pirates there. Russian oil is more secure, says analyst Alex Brideau at the Eurasia Group.
It's right next door. It's being carried over a pipeline via land routes rather than through these sea lanes.
This week, Russia also committed to help China build nuclear energy plants. And for its part, China will lend nearly $2 billion to Russian banks. Zhao Huasheng at Shanghai's Fudan University finds the mutual back-scratching historic.
This is the best period ever in China-Russia relations because both sides treat each other as equals.
But is this new alliance a new Eastern bloc? The two countries have come together to blast the U.S. dollar and its global dominance. In these parts, though, most think Russia and China are simply doing business. As one analyst puts it, it's an axis of convenience. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
It took just 7 months for the Dow to rally from the 6,500 range back above 10,000 today. We'll have more of the hopeful data when we do the numbers. Sometimes statistical probabilities can sound very improbable. Did you know, for example, that one in every 3,759 fatal accidental falls starts from some kind of playground equipment? But you're 85 times more likely to fall to your death from a chair. We found those odd insights on a new website that launched today. It's called Book of Odds, and we're joined now by its founder, Amram Shapiro. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome.
So why the subject of odds? Why did you want to pursue this particular idea?
Well, about 3 years ago, I realized that you could look up words in a dictionary, connotations of words in a thesaurus, and of course you could find almost anything on the web. But if you really wanted to understand a probability and what it meant to you in particular, there was really nowhere to go. And it occurred to me that that would be an awfully useful thing to create.
So how have you set this up for people who go to check out the website? How does it work?
Well, suppose, for example, you visit your accountant and he tells you you're facing certain odds of an audit, or you visit a doctor and the doctor says you face certain odds of a bad side effect, and you have a number. Let's suppose that number is 1 in 144. That doesn't really mean a whole lot to you. But if you go to the site and go search on that particular odds, you can find other things that might mean a great deal to you. So if you're a baseball fan and you learn that the odds that the next batter will hit a triple are 1 in 144, then the game will inform your understanding of that number and maybe tell you whether to worry or not to worry.
You can do some pretty interesting mashups here. I was checking it out earlier, and I found that the odds that an employed person 16 or older is a reporter or a correspondent are 1 in 2,667. And then I matched that up and found out that the odds of running into a reporter are about the same as running into a manicurist or a pedicurist.
Well, you've gotten into the spirit of the thing, which is that you may find that two things you had never associated will meet each other through the numbers themselves.
So where does this research come from?
We were able to attract a great group of researchers who have been working with us in stealth mode for the last 3 years. And of course, our commitment, since this is a reference work, is to keep it updated on a regular basis.
So I couldn't figure out how to get the answer to this one when I typed it in. What are the odds of success for a website like this? How do you hope to keep the site up and running? What's the business model?
Our business model is very simple. We're going to rely on three things. One is advertising. Second, we have such good researchers and such a wonderful and interesting new form of data that we're able to work with business partners and provide services. And then the third thing is that we actually will be selling products. Every single one of our hundreds of thousands of odd statements can be turned into a T-shirt or some other swag that you can have and play with. So we're making use of the extreme personalization that the web makes possible.
Amram Shapiro is founder of the Book of Odds website. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome, Bob.
Milk prices are sure easier to swallow these days, lowest since 1979. Good news for milk drinkers, not so if you're a farmer struggling to stay in business. Last week, the Senate approved a $350 million rescue plan. But dairy producers are still scrambling to save money. And Missouri farmers are paying close attention to how New Zealand immigrants feed their cows. From KBIA, Maureen McCollum reports.
Kevin Vanderpool really wanted to expand his dairy business a few years ago. The problem for this New Zealander is that farmland in his country is super expensive. So he went on a global quest for land. He looked in Australia and Chile, but Vanderpool eventually settled on this farm in southwest Missouri. Land here costs about $2,000 an acre versus $20,000 back in New Zealand.
We wanted to find somewhere that grew grass, and we found southwest Missouri was a good area for us to go.
Vanderpool could now grow exactly the type of grass he needed, grass that cows eat while roaming open fields. This concept is revolutionary in the U.S. dairy industry. Milk cows here are usually kept in stalls most of the day and fed corn and grains. That setup allows each cow to produce more milk, but it costs three times as much to feed cows this way. Here's why that matters. With the price of milk at its lowest in years, Missouri farmers who keep cows in stalls are losing money. Those with cows grazing in fields are breaking even.
New Zealand has been very successful with milking cows from pasture, and we wanted to see if we can use some of those skills learned in New Zealand in America.
Dairymen are losing, they're bleeding everywhere.
Stacy Hamilton is a dairy specialist with the University of Missouri Extension. He lobbied hard for the New Zealanders to come. Today, there are 20 New Zealanders on four Missouri farms. His research does show farmers can benefit economically by moving their cows to the pasture. For one, it cuts down on vet bills because conditions are generally more sanitary.
In a lot of freestall operations,
The cows get done eating, they get a drink, they walk 10 feet, and they lay down in a stall, and they may be putting their udder in a manure pile.
Hamilton says grazing techniques can also help save farmers a lot of time. Less feeding, less milking. And that's important because many kids aren't interested in the long hours of a dairy farmer.
So they may be milking 8 to 12 hours a day. That's why their kids didn't want to come back, because they never saw their mom and dad. Mom and dad was in the shed the whole time.
Mike Meyer understands that feeling. None of his three sons want to take over his dairy farm. Meyer himself almost gave up on the business completely. That is, until Hamilton and a New Zealand worker from Vanderpool's farm introduced Meyer to the grazing method. The transition allowed him to finally take a hunting vacation last winter.
I was in South Dakota pheasant hunting.
Meyer didn't need to purchase extra land for grazing. He took the area where he used to grow corn and alfalfa for the cows and started growing grass on it instead.
So when I start implementing what those guys were showing me, it's really starting to work now.
Meyer wants to purchase even more cows next year. Back at Kevin Vanderpool's farm, he watches hundreds of cows line up, waiting patiently for workers to attach milking machines to their udders. Vanderpool says here's how he measures success. Some Missouri locals were skeptical when he first arrived with his grazing technique. At first, Vanderpool noticed that conversations at the local cafe would come to a dead stop when he walked through the door. Now, everyone wants to buy him a cup of coffee. From Harwood, Missouri, I'm Maureen McCollum for Marketplace.
Coming up, ads that try shocking you into submission.
Sometimes the fear appeal can be so effective that people focus on the fear itself and miss the underlying message associated with the appeal.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shot up 144 points, or nearly 1.5%, to close at 10,015. The NASDAQ climbed by 32 points, 1.5%, to finish at 2172. The S&P 500 ticked up 18 points, or 1.75%, to end the day at 1092. 25 out of the 30 Dow stocks rose in value today, and it's fitting financial companies powered up on the day the Dow broke the 10,000-point barrier. J.P. Morgan Chase banked an almost 3.33% gain. Bank of America and Wells Fargo were both up more than 4%. Intel was another big market mover today, up 1.75%. The computer chip maker's profits topped estimates and signaled a bump in computer sales. IBM was up 1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for September. A trip to New Orleans is on President Obama's calendar. He is scheduled to hold a town hall meeting in the city. And it's Get Smart About Credit Day. Bankers enter the classroom to talk to kids about the credit facts of life. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. The military seems to be having an easier time looking for a few good men. For the first time since the creation of an all-volunteer military back in 1973, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines met or even exceeded every recruitment target for the just-ended fiscal year, men and women, of course. The current job market is one likely reason, but there are also others. Here's our Washington Bureau Chief, John Dimsdale.
Just a few years ago, most branches of the military struggled to meet their enlistment goals. Douglas Smith, a spokesman for the Army's recruiting command, says it's been challenging for enlistment officers, and not just because the Army is waging two wars.
The factors are criminal background, overweight, medical conditions. Also, barriers would be people who have not achieved their high school diploma.
One reason all the services hit their yearly targets, according to the Pentagon, is the military benefits package. Average enlistment bonuses are running $14,000. Housing subsidies, health care, cost of living salary adjustments, and enhanced college tuition reimbursements look pretty good in this economy. And the military survey show advertising is hitting home with the 17 to 24-year-old target audience.
Here you'll discover adventure. The chance to give something back to your country, and the kind of training that truly prepares you for the future.
To achieve this success, the Army spent a record $22,000 per recruit on advertising, marketing, and enlistment officers. At the University of Maryland Center for Research on Military Organization, David R. Siegel doesn't expect that to last.
My anticipation is they will be rewarded for their recruiting success by having their recruiting resources cut back. The Defense Department and the Congress are going to say, well, since you're getting all the recruits you need, you don't need as many recruiters.
Victims of their own success. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Military recruiters might be able to find a silver lining of sorts in high unemployment among the young. On the other hand, commentator David Frum sees a gray cloud.
If you are over 30, be grateful. Tough as this recession is for you, it is much, much worse for those who are younger. And toughest of all for the youngest people looking for work. Half the young people, 16 to 24, now looking for a job, cannot find one. It will take many quarters of economic recovery before all of these young people find work. The generation that endured the Great Depression was shaped by it. They craved the security of lifetime employment at a giant company. They felt little patience for the next generation when it began to demand creativity and self-expression at work. Will this Great Recession have an equal cultural effect? In the booming 1990s, we celebrated entrepreneurship and risk-taking. What will we celebrate in the recession-scarred 2010s? Here's a suggestion. A grand national focus on the skill level of the population. Remember, many of the most employable young Americans aren't in the workforce at all. They are attending college. It's the least skilled two-thirds of the youth population who are so unsuccessfully searching for work now. And there's a lot of evidence that the skill levels of the bottom two-thirds of the American workforce are deteriorating. Immigration policies that accept huge numbers of less skilled workers. Bad schools that fail to teach the children of those immigrants what they need to know. And very high dropout rates among the children of immigrants. These are the trends that led the Educational Testing Service to issue a warning. The American workforce of 2025 will be less literate and less skilled than the American workforce of 1995. And this time, there will be many fewer of the steady, if dull, jobs that provided security to the post-Depression generation. The blue-collar job on the assembly line, the clerical data processing job. Life for people with fewer skills is becoming a lot harder and scarier at a time when there are soon to be a lot more of them.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We welcome your comments at marketplace.org. Viewer discretion is advised if you'll be taking a subway ride in New York anytime soon. I'm talking about some creepy images on display for the next few months as part of a new public health ad campaign. It's aimed at scaring people away from too many sugary drinks. The graphics are, well, graphic depictions of what I'll just call the abominable abdominal results. The campaign cost the city almost $300,000 to develop, but it got Sally Herships wondering, do in-your-face ads like this really work?
There are some new posters in New York City subways. One shows a soda being poured into a glass, but the drink turns into globs of veiny fat. The tagline reads, "Are you pouring on the pounds? Don't drink yourself fat." It's kind of gross, but this type of shocking ad has been around for a while. Remember this?
This is drugs.
This is your brain on drugs.
Or how about this from the Truth Campaign?
Do you know how many people tobacco kills every day?
Shock ads seem popular, but do they work? Why do advertisers use such over-the-top ads? Patty Williams teaches marketing at Wharton. She says with a lot of consumption, especially junk food, we, consumers, are very aware of the pleasure we'll get in the short term, but not so good when it comes to thinking about long-term costs. Take flossing your teeth.
People don't do it because they neglect the long-term benefits and they focus to a greater degree on those short-term costs, which is that flossing maybe isn't the most exciting way to spend a couple minutes of my life.
I know, I suddenly am thinking I don't floss enough.
Nobody does.
Because we're not thinking about the future. So advertisers try to shock us into doing it. But most people know we shouldn't smoke cigarettes and that doing drugs is a bad idea. Chip Heath is author of Made to Stick, Why Some Ideas Survive and Others Die. He says because people already know this, advertisers use shocking ads to try to change the way we feel.
Nobody has a baby because they understand intellectually that having kids would be a good idea. Nobody ever gets married because somebody says, let me explain to you why we should be married. We change in our life because of a deep emotional desire to change.
But can an ad really change someone's behavior? Heath says the ideas in an ad are more likely to stick with people if they possess certain characteristics.
Unexpected and emotional, with very concrete, visualizable images.
But just because an ad sticks doesn't mean it's successful. Heath says consumers need clear-cut instructions, like drink one less soda a day and you'll lose 15 pounds a year. Otherwise, they won't change. And Patty Williams says there's another reason shock ads can backfire. They can scare audiences too much.
Sometimes the fear appeal can be so effective that people focus on the fear itself and miss the underlying message associated with the appeal.
They're distracted because it's so scary.
So they miss the point.
So the anti-soda ad in the subway uses another strategy, disgust. Williams says people like to be grossed out. Will it work? I headed for the subway to find out.
I'll definitely remember that image for sure.
Does it gross you out? Do you think it's a gross ad?
Yeah, I'm pretty queasy. It's pretty disgusting, but it's effective, I would say.
I think it's gross, but I don't think anyone would really pay that much attention to it.
And that's why both Patty Williams and author Chip Heath say in order for any ad to be really effective, they have to be part of a larger campaign. And New York City says it's doing just that, posting calorie counts in fast food restaurants and funding healthy eating programs throughout the city. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Think that icky ad might stop you from popping open a cola? You can see it on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this note, Bruce Wasserstein, the CEO of the investment bank Lazard Limited, died today. He was 61 years old. Wasserstein was known in the financial world for his deal-making abilities and the impressive wealth he earned from it. Of him, author William Cohan wrote, "He made more from investment banking than any man on the planet." And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 144 points, nearly 1.5%. The Nasdaq added 32 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 packed on 18 points, 1.75%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gerwitz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Next time on the program, being called waspy isn't usually a compliment.
Worse, the adjective is pejorative. Waspy is reserved for horse-faced women, tight-assed men, penny pinchers, and a cappella groups.
All right, I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.